Good evening, everyone. This week's Parshas, Parshas Va'era, Tavshin Nun, Tavshin Ayin Tes. First class back since my trip to Eretz Yisrael. Still a little jet lagged, so hopefully I'll be making sense. Okay, page 318. This is the beginning of the Parsha. And the parasha begins, Vayidaber Elohim el Moshe, and Hashem spoke to Moshe, Vayomer lo ani Hashem, and he said to him, I am Hashem. Okay, so there's two things here. Number one, the pasuk starts off using the name of Hashem Elohim, and then when Hashem speaks to Moshe, he says, Ani Hashem, using the name Havaya. Why the change? In the same pasuk, Hashem is first referred to as Elohim. When Hashem speaks, he refers to Hashem himself as Havaya. And what exactly is Hashem saying to Moshe when he says, Ani Hashem, I am Hashem? So Rashi says that Elohim, we always know, is the name of Hashem as the God of judgment. The word Vayidaber is also very at times used to imply harsh speech. So Rashi, the very first Rashi in the Parsha, top line in the right column, Vayidaber Elohim el Moshe, Elohim spoke to Moshe, Dibur Itay Mishpat, Hashem spoke judgment with Moshe, Al Shikshu L'daber V'loimar, or the fact that Moshe questioned and said, Lama Harei Ois L'mazeh, why did you do bad with this nation? If we turn back to the end of last week's Parsha, where Moshe Rabbeinu is told by Hashem to go to Paray, to tell to let the Jewish people go out, Moshe does so. What does Paro do? He makes the servitude even worse. And when Moshe leaves Paro, he says to Hashem, that's in last week's Parsha, so page 316, Lama Rei Oisa Lama Zeh, why have you done bad, evil with this nation? Lama Zeh Shlachten, why have you sent me? V'yazbasi al Paro l'daber b'shmecha, and from the time that I came to speak to Paro, to speak in your name, Hera Lama Zeh, things have gotten worse for this nation. And you have not saved your people. So Moshe was questioning Hashem. And the beginning of this week's parsha that uses the words Vayidaber Elohim is implying that when Hashem spoke to Moshe now, he spoke to Moshe in a, so to speak, harsh and judgment and way of judgment with Moshe, chastising Moshe, taking Moshe to judgment, so to speak, over the fact that he had complained to Hashem. So that is why the name Elohim appears, because that means the word judge. Elohim is the name of Hashem. We refer to Hashem as the God of judgment. And there, and the point is, Rashi says, that Hashem spoke mishpat. He spoke judgment with Moshe over complaining. Then he said to him, Vayimra elav ani Hashem. Hashem says to Moshe, I am Hashem. What does this mean? So Rashi explains, Neman l'shalem sachar toiv l'mitzhalchim l'fonai. I am trusted to give reward to those who follow me. I didn't send you for no reason. I didn't send you in vain. But rather to fulfill the words, the promise that I made to the forefathers, to Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov. This wording, this phrase of Ani Hashem, we find in many places, is explained in this manner. Meaning, Ani Hashem neman li para kshehu aimer etzel einish. Ani Hashem is meant to say that I am trusted to pay reward. So, according to Rashi, Vayimer lav Ani Hashem, and actually, if you read the psukim continue. It says, I appeared to Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov with the name Kel Shakai. My name Hashem was not known to them. I established a covenant with them, etc. And Hashem says, now it's time for me to go and to fulfill that covenant, that promise I made with them. But Rashi is telling us that the words Ani Hashem, when Hashem says to Moshe, I am Hashem, he's saying to Moshe that I, meaning this name Ani Hashem, Hashem is now using the word Ani Hashem, is because we find different times that these words Ani Hashem are said in the context of Hashem saying, I am trustworthy to reward those who go before me. And as Rashi says, Hashem says to Moshe, basically, Moshe says, why did you send me? And Rashi says, Hashem said, I didn't send you for no reason. I sent you in order to fulfill the promises that I made to Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov. Okay. So now, according to Rashi, we have an understanding as to why the name of Hashem starts off Elohim, which means God of judgment. And now, and then why the same pasuk Hashem, when he's speaking, says, Ani Hashem, I am Hashem. Because Hashem spoke to Moshe in a way of judgment for complaining about what Hashem had done. And the point of Ani Hashem is to say that your whole problem of why did I send you and why you haven't saved your nation, I didn't send you for no reason. I sent you in order to fulfill the promise. Now, if we think about it, what is Hashem saying to Moshe? I mean, Moshe says, from the time that you sent me, things have gotten worse. Why did you send me? You haven't saved your nation. So what is Hashem saying to Moshe? I didn't send you for no reason. I sent you to go ahead and to fulfill my promise to Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. But Moshe's whole problem was, basically, I don't see that happening. It's gotten worse. It's gotten worse.
Because I didn't speak to Avraham.
It's gotten worse. So if it's gotten worse, what is Hashem saying to him? I didn't send you for no reason.
He says to him that, why did you send me now? If I'm not going to take him out now, why are you sending me now?
So then what's Hashem responding?
Huh?
Oh, what? Why are you sending me now?
Why are you sending me now?
Yeah.
Wait, see, I'll go when I'm supposed to go when it's going to happen. I see.
Okay, so what's the answer? Huh? Now, what's the answer? What's Hashem responding to Moshe?
What you just said is the answer.
I didn't say anything yet. What are you saying? What's Hashem's response?
No, before he only mentioned that's one of the complaints. If you're not ready to do it now, why did you send me?
What's
now?
The answer? Is Hashem answering that here?
Yeah.
Where? What's the answer?
The answer is because I'm. It doesn't have.
Yeah,
to
but
be
Moshe is saying that it doesn't seem to be the right time. So what's the answer? It is.
It doesn't have to be the right time.
Okay. So the thing. So let's. So if we go ahead and we look at Moshe says, why'd you send me? Things don't seem to be working out. Why'd you send me? Hashem says, I didn't send you for no reason. I'm sending you to fulfill the promise. But again, that's Moshe's whole question. Moshe's whole question is, how is that happening? So it could very well be that according to what Rashi's saying is that Hashem is saying to Moshe, Moshe, you're questioning, why am I being sent? The answer is you're being sent to fulfill the promise. If you don't understand it, you don't understand it. But that's what's happening here. That's what's happening here. You have a question, you're not understanding, but this is what's happening. This is what's happening. And basically, as Rashi says, that Moshe was also being rebuked for complaining. But Moshe has his question, Hashem is not responding to it. He's just saying, if you want to know what's happening now is, I'm fulfilling the promise. You don't understand it? You don't understand it. No. But this is what I'm doing. Okay. Now, I want to share with you a very, very beautiful thought from Harav David Feinstein Shlita. And there is a sefer called Kol Deidi, which is a collection of his comments on Chumash. He didn't write it directly. Somebody else who heard it from him, I think, wrote it. And he also addresses the question of the change of Hashem's name in the Pasuk. He does not talk about Rashi. He addresses the question about why does the Pasuk begin first with Hashem's name as Elohim and then becomes Ani Hashem. And he addresses it. He addresses it in his way. It's a very interesting way. And I would like to take what he says and apply it to Rashi. So he begins saying, Elohim, as we've said, is the name of Hashem when Hashem is being referred to as a judge, as the God of judgment, as the God who demands justice. Hashem, Havaya, Yud, Hey, Vav, and Hey, is actually the name of Hashem that depicts Midas Harachamim, Hashem's attribute of mercy. And what Hashem is saying to Moshe is, Vayidaber Elohim al Moshe. Elohim spoke to Moshe. Moshe perceives what Hashem has done with making the servitude harder as an act of Hashem's strict judgment. Hashem says, I am Hashem. What I am doing right now is not an act of judgment. It's an act of mercy. And the explanation is because, as Hashem has said to Avraham, how long do the Jews have to be enslaved for before they can get out of Mitzrayim? 400 years, right? At this point of time, it was only 210 years had passed. The 400 years had not been fulfilled. I mean, it's a whole discussion how it's fulfilled exactly. Lots of discussion about that. And one way of answering that why, if there's only been there for 210 years, how does the 400 years get fulfilled, is because things got so bad at the end. So basically, the slavery of 400 years landed up being fulfilled within 210. But that could only happen if Hashem made the servitude worse. And therefore, what Hashem is saying to Moshe is, you're wondering why things got worse. You know why things got worse? Because if you want to be able to, if you want them to be able to get out now, the only way they can get out now is if I make it worse, so that all the aspects of the 400 years of servitude can be fulfilled. And in essence, in many Mepharshim say, the Jewish people needed to get out now, because spiritually they're in very bad shape. If they wouldn't have gotten out now, they would have been lost completely spiritually. So Moshe, Rabbeinu Shalom, now created the situation that they should be able to get out now, and not have to go through 400 years, actually. So Moshe Rabbeinu says, why are you sending me? You know, things have gotten worse. Why are you sending me? The answer is, it looks like it's getting worse, but it's not for the purpose of getting worse. It's for the purpose of getting them out. And that's what, so that's what Reb David explains. You first have the name of Elohim. Vayedaber Elohim HaMoshe. Elohim spoke to Moshe, because Moshe perceives Hashem as Elohim, the God of strict judgment. And Hashem says, no, Ani Hashem, what I'm doing right now is an act of mercy. It's the attribute of mercy that I'm displaying. And it's the name of Hashem that's really here. So that's how he answers the question. Now, I think that we can take this concept and stick it into Rashi in the sense of what was Hashem saying to Moshe. Moshe says, Rashi says, you said, Lamazel Shalachtani, why do you send me? Says Rabbi Shalom, I sent you because I have to fulfill my promise. I have to give the reward that I promised Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Okay, so we asked, but that's what Moshe is trying to understand. He's trying to understand how that's happening. And the response seems to be, you know, I'm trusted to fulfill, to reward those who I promised reward to. I have to fulfill my promise. That's why I sent you. And according to what Reb David Feinstein is saying, Rashi doesn't say this, but the meaning behind what Rashi is saying is, when Hashem says to Moshe, why did I send you? I didn't send you in vain. I sent you to fulfill my promise, means to say that this process of you going now, by which now it actually became the reason to make, or became the cause, or the means, by which the servitude became worse, is so that I can fulfill my promise. That's why I'm sending you. Why did I send you? I sent you because you had to fulfill my promise. Because by going in and sending you now, which now triggers Pirat to go in and make the servitude worse, now I'm able to fulfill my promise. Now I'm able to fulfill what I promised Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. So perhaps, again, Rashi doesn't say it, but the idea behind Rashi is, when Rashi says Moshe, Hashem's response to Moshe, of why did you send me? I didn't send you in vain. I sent you to fulfill the promise. And Moshe says, well, that doesn't seem to be happening. Hashem's saying, no, that's exactly is what's happening. I'm sending you to fulfill the promise. The only way I'll be able to fulfill my promise to get them out is if I make the servitude worse, that the 400 years can be fulfilled earlier. So perhaps that's the meaning behind what Rashi says.
They would have to do, instead of doing putting in an 8-hour day, they had to put in a 16-hour day, so they had to do twice as much work.
Right.
So that's how it comes
Correct.
Down.
That's how it boils down. Now, so Reb David then uses this to discuss a very basic principle of our Amun of the Ribbono Shel Olam, which is Koma Dabed Rachmano L'Tavavad. Whatever the Ribbono Shel Olam does is for the good. Even things that don't seem to be for our good, our emunah, our faith, and our trust in the Rabbeinu Sholem is that it is all for the good. That's exactly what's happening here. Moshe Rabbeinu says, it's terrible, what's going on? The answer is, no, this is what has to be. This is, on the contrary, this is what's bringing about the Jewish people should be saved. And he brings on a famous Gemara in Nedarim. The Gemara in Nedarim talks about a pasuk in Tehillim, where David HaMelech says, Oitcha Hashem ki onaftabi. Thank you, Hashem, for being angry with me. Bi yoshev apcho snachameni. When your anger disappears, I'll be consoled. David HaMelech says, I thank you, Hashem, for being angry with me. What's pshat? So the Gemara brings down Rabbi Yosef, who explains with the following story. And it's a story that, you know, you've heard it more than once. Just that here it happens in one way, usually happens in another way. The Gemara talks about a man who planned to make a journey by boat to complete a business deal to make a lot of money. Before the trip happened, the man became very ill, and he couldn't make the trip. And as he laid there in his sick bed, he was complaining bitterly to Rabbi Nishalaylam, why do you deprive me of this? Stuck to Gemara, later on he found out that the boat sunk, and no one survived. And therefore, and then what did he say, says the Gemara? He says to Hashem, Oit Hashem, you can have to be. I thank you for being angry at me. Now that you actually, what you displayed as anger to me, as making me sick and not being able to make the money that I wanted to do, that's exactly why I was able to survive. Right? By us, it's always the story about the airplane, right? It's the airplane story, right? You missed the airplane, and therefore you survived. Excuse me, but this is the point of, in the Gemara, you know, it was with a boat. And then Reb David brings down something else that's also a very interesting point. It's a very common point that's made, and that is that we know that during World War II, as the war began, Vilna became free. Vilna became free Lithuania. Whether it was free or not, the Russians, whatever it is, the Russians were still in control, but it became a place where Jews were able to flee. Right? They couldn't stay in Poland because of the war, and they would flee to Vilna for safety. That was temporary, but it was safety for a time. That's what my father did. And there were a group of, and this happened to a number of yeshiva students, yeshiva bachrim, that whatever the reason was, and I know that my father told me that there were a number of stories like this that he had heard, but basically the Russian authorities, they used to take rabbis or yeshiva students, and because they were religious people, what did they do to them? Send them off to Siberia. They find some kind of problem with them. Actually, they were all illegal. And are they illegal? They would arrest them and send them to Siberia. My father told me a story that one Russian secret service man came up to my grandmother and told her that, go tell these boys that they better get out of here fast because they're about to be arrested and sent to Siberia. But there are a number of people that were sent to Siberia. And when they went to Siberia, they were, of course, very upset. Here, if they could stay in Vilna, they'd be free. Relatively free. And in Siberia, you're going to Siberia. At the end of the day, how did they survive? Because they went to Siberia. Because anybody who was left in Vilna was killed by the Nazis. And because they went to Siberia and survived Siberia, they were able to live and to come to America and build lives and to continue and build their lives. There's a story that I one time saw. I mentioned this story before. There's a story with the Chafetz Chaim. It's a very interesting story. The story goes that there was a yeshiva student of his, who received a draft notice to the Russian army. And you know what you know, when you got a draft notice to the Russian army, you know, you're in trouble. They used to try doing things to themselves, cut off their finger, like different things to make it that they couldn't be taken into the army. So there was one father who had to take his son to the induction place where a doctor draft would check them out. I don't know if he starved himself to make himself look good and sick. I'm not sure exactly, but he went. And before him and his son went before the draft board, they went to the Chafetz Chaim for a bracha, for a blessing, that he should be able to get out of being drafted. It did happen. And the Chafetz Chaim looked at them and said, basically, and what's so bad if he'll learn how to shoot a gun? Here they came to the Chafetz Chaim, asking for a bracha, they should get out of the army, and what does he say to them? And was hazeh shlecht, what's so bad if he'll learn how to shoot a gun? That's all the Chafetz Chaim said. Nope. What are you going to do? That's all the Chafetz Chaim said, that's all he said. Okay, well, they went ahead, and he came before the draft board, and if I remember the story correctly, the doctor was about to smear him, and that he was gonna write some kind of a medical exemption. All of a sudden, an officer walks into the room, takes a look at the boy, and he says, "I want him." At that point, there was nothing to do anymore, and the boy was taken into the Russian army, and he actually became an expert marksman. Became a top marksman. Also, he was trained very well in fixing guns and in shooting. And at a certain point of time, he landed up during World War II running away to the forest and joining the partisans. And the partisans were like, you know, what are we going to do with you? Until he showed them what he could do with a gun. And that's how he survived the war. That's how he survived. That's what the Chafetz Chaim meant. Vasazei shlechta vet Iceland says shisana bezim shisana bix. What's going to be so bad if he learns how to shoot a gun? The Chafetz Chaim in his, you know, in his special Ruach HaKodesh knew what was destined for this young man. And what was destined for this young man was to be drafted, to learn how to shoot, and that would be the reason why he'd survive. And many times in life we get the chance to be able to see Hashem's secret ways. Sometimes we don't. But at the end of the day, our emunah, our faith, and our betachon of Rabbeinu Shlomo is that Oitcha Hashem can have to be. I thank you for being angry because I know that everything you do is for my best. Okay, let's now move on to a different part of the parsha. This parsha has most of the makas, most of the plagues in it. And I want to point out something by the plagues. And it's interesting. And this is going to be on page 328. This is Perek Zayin, Pasuk Chaf Beis, chapter 7, verse 22.
Okay.
Now this is, you know, the first sign that Moshe had done before Paro was when he threw his staff down and turned into a snake, right? And it says that Paro's sorcerers did the same thing. And the same thing happens here by the first makkah of blood, right? What happens? Everything turns into blood. Turn back one page. Where it says, Pasuk Chaf, Vayasu kein Moshe v'Aaron kasher tziva Hashem. Moshe and Aaron did as Hashem commanded. Vayorim amate, he lifted up his staff, Vayachas hamayim asher bayar, and he smote the water that was in the Nile. Leinei Paro leinei avadev, in front of Paro, in front of his servants. Vayavchu kol hamayim asher bayar ladam, and all the water in the Nile turned into blood. Vadagar asher bayar meis havayivash ha'ar. And the fish in the Nile died, and the entire Nile became vile. But lo yachlu Mitzrayim l'shtois mayim min ha'yar, the Egyptians were not able to drink water from the Nile. V'yadam achleretz Mitzrayim, and there was blood throughout the land of Egypt. V'yasu chen chartumei Mitzrayim bilateihem, and the sorcerers of Mitzrayim did so bilateihem. What is latehem? So Rashi says latehem means with their incantations. They said heji-biji words and they did the same thing. And therefore, vayechazak leiv paro, the heart of paro was hardened, v'leishama aleihem, and he didn't listen to them, kashadibar Hashem as Hashem spoke. So this is already the second time where it says that the Egyptian sorcerers did the same thing with their magic, with their incantations. So I don't know why at this point in the parasha, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky discusses this more than at an earlier point. But at this point, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky launches into a very interesting discussion where we see here the sorcerers being able to perform what we generally refer to as kishif, magic, sorcery, and it's just the idea of kishif, of sorcery, is something that we find many times in the Chumash, and many times in Tanakh. The Torah talks about, actually forbids us to perform kishif, to perform sorcery. Chashef alei sachaya. Somebody performs sorcery shouldn't live, right? The Torah talks about it. Tanakh talks about it. We have Midrashim, Gemaras that talk about kishif, witchcraft. They talk about shadim, what we translate in English as demons. But Shadim are explained to be, you know, they're somewhat in between physical and spiritual beings, but they don't do positive things. And there's a famous Rambam that says they don't really exist, but the vast majority of Rishonim disagree, and the Vilna Gaon was very strongly disagreeing with this. And at the end of the day, you know, according to most Rishonim, this whole concept of Kishuv, you know, at one time existed. At one time it clearly existed. Like I say, the Torah talks about it. The Gemara talks about it. At the end of the day, though, we know that nowadays doesn't seem to be around. Doesn't seem to be around. In the way, the Torah talks about it, and the way that Gemara talks about it, it just, we don't have it anymore.
Don't understand it anyway.
Well, but we don't have it anymore. And Rabbi Yaakov here at this point in this parsha talks about how to understand that. What happened? What happened with this power that seemed to have existed to the point that the Torah has to warn us not to engage in it, and it's no more. What happened? What's the change? How do we understand that change? Shlomo Kamenetsky explains that we know that the Ribbono Shel Olam has created the world in a manner that there has to be, let's call it, equilibrium. Meaning, if there is a power of good, there has to be a power of evil that counters it. If there's not going to be something that counters the power of good, then we don't have Bechira. Then we don't have a choice. Bechira, free will, means that we have a choice. If the Ribbono Shel Olam is going to do something that unquestionably, right, just has to be the Ribbono Shel Olam, there's no way to deny it, then in that sense, we've lost our Bechira, lost our free will. And the idea of having Bechira, of having free will, is something that really has to exist in every facet of what of our lives, in any kind of circumstance. And therefore, whenever there is a power, a positive force, a power, a force of good, there has to be a force of evil that counters it in some way. Therefore, says Yerbankiv, when there were prophets, and a prophet was, you know, a prophet was a special person who would basically perform a miracle to show that his words were correct, there has to be something that's going to counter that. Now, as Rabbi Yaakov points out, you know, you could prove if there are people who you can show something in front of their face, and if they want to deny, they're going to deny it. You know, even something that's obvious, people deny because they have a desire to do what they want. They're going to deny even something that's obvious. But when you deny something that's obvious, you have to have some kind of explanation. It may be a wild explanation, maybe a far-fetched explanation, but you got to have something to latch onto. And therefore, says Yerbankiv, and he says, and the famous example of this is the Ramban's comment by the Kriya Samsa, by the splitting of the Red Sea. The Torah mentions that a eastern wind was blowing and the water split. Now, eastern winds don't split large bodies of water. That doesn't happen. So why did it occur? Says the Ramban, it occurred because if it wouldn't have occurred, then there'd be no Bechira. There'd be no free will regarding this miracle. This miracle would have to be accepted. No one would have the ability to deny. But once there's a wind, then if you want to deny, you got your excuse. No, this was a super powerful wind, and it was able to split the water. All you need is something far-fetched to be able to have your Bechira able to manifest itself. And that's why the Ramban says this wind blew by the splitting of the Red Sea. So therefore, Yerachem Kanetsky explains that this is how we have to understand why at one point of time we had these kinds of supernatural powers that existed, because those were the powers of evil that would counteract the forces of good. When there were Nevi'im, when there were prophets, a prophet was such a strong influence, such a strong experience when he gave over something that no one would even have the possibility of denying it, of going against it. You know what creates the possibility to go against it? No, it's the prophet. It's Nishka Navi. He's a kishuv macher. He does kishuv. He does sorcery. Anybody who may know anything about it, right, may realize that there's two different things here. As a matter of fact, as Yerbankiv points out, we know that by Dam, the sorcerers were able to replicate it. By Tzvardeh, by frogs, they were able to replicate it. Came to Kenim, the lice, they couldn't replicate it. And what do they say to Paro? Etzba Elokimi. It's the finger of God. It's an act of God. Because everybody knows, right? Everybody knows, right? It's part of the, in the Kishif, in the Book of Witchcraft, everybody knows that witchcraft cannot influence something as small as lice. Okay? So the sorcerer themselves say to Paro, it's an act of God. Paro doesn't accept it. Says Rabbi Yankov, why? Because Paro says, yeah, sure, right? That's the rule. That's not the rule. You're making it up. He's a better sorcerer than you. You don't want to admit that you can't do what he does. So you say, in the sorcery book, it says such a thing so small you can't have control over. Because again, you need an excuse, but you need something. Got to do something. You have to have something. The ability for Moshe's actions to be denied was because Paro would just say, Kishif, they can't do it. Well, he's an expert. He had a much better teacher, has a better Kabbalah. Yeah. Whatever it is. And therefore, so says Rabbi Yankov, that as long as there was prophecy, there had to be Kishif, had to be this power of witchcraft in order to challenge the power of prophecy. Which now, at a certain point of time, we know the Jewish people lost prophecy. They lost prophecy. Okay? But they still had what's called a baskol, says Rabbi Yankov, a heavenly voice. They're able to engage a heavenly voice to find out things. Okay, what's going to go ahead, says Rabbi Yankov, and counteract the heavenly voice? A shade. Okay? A shade. A shade, what we call a demon, is like somewhere between physical and spiritual. He's kind of half and half, or a nishtah in and nishtah her. Okay? So the same way the Bas Kol is, so to speak, a low frequency prophecy, the next thing that counters it is a lower frequency of the power of evil. And he says when there were Bali Mephis, people who were able to do wonders, which my understanding is referring to the Amoraim in the Gemara, because when the Amoraim in the Gemara were able to do wonders, okay, you still had Shadim that were able, as the wording is, there are demons that used to reveal a spiritual force from the dark chariot, from the chariot of evil, from the chariot of impurity. As long as there was some kind of a spiritual force that could influence people for the positive, there has to be some kind of a spiritual force that will be negative. But once we come to a point of time that we don't have any of these spiritual forces, we don't have any of these supernatural powers at any level, once we don't have them, then there's no need for the other force. There's no purpose for the counterforce. There's no need to be able to have this existence of sorcery when there's nothing for it to counter. And therefore, at this point, where there are no more spiritual or supernatural forces for good, we're basically left to dealing with the physical world, the physical world, which is a battle between the seichel, the intellect, and the desire. You don't need anything else to be able to create bechira. You don't need anything else to challenge the power of good. The natural world and the forces within it, within a person, within the world, that's enough to create the bechira.
Is that something like the Rambam and Nevochim?
About what?
Trying to explain something to someone that doesn't.
I mean, at the end of the day, it's all going to be about having to deal with what a person with their intellect could be able to can get to, and if we'd be able to keep our intellect free of the influences of our desires, our intellect would be able to get to be able to understand and see things very clearly. But it's a battle between our intellect and our desires. Well. Now, in the fact that there are no supernatural powers, it's just the physical world, we don't need anything to create a challenge. The challenge comes from within that world itself. And therefore, there is no need. Says Rabbi Yankov, very interesting. We know that Yosef, right, when Yosef was taken out of the pit, Paro says to him, I understand you ought to interpret dreams. What does Yosef say? Biladai, it's not me. Elokim yaneh shalom Paro. The Rebbeinu Shlom is going to respond to the welfare of Paro. It's not me. So it's interesting. Typically, Paris says, I understand you know how to interpret dreams. So Yosef could have said yes, right? Even if the Rabbanu Shlom is giving him the power to do so, he could have said, correct, yeah. What does he say? No, it's the Rabbanu Shlom. So we always interpret that as Yosef. Big tzitkas on Yosef's part, doesn't want to take any, doesn't want to take any credit for himself. He always attributes everything to the Rabbanu Shlom. There's another story that Reb Yanka brings down from the Sefer Daniel. When Daniel has to go ahead and he is talking to the king of Babel, the Nebuchadnezzar, and the Nebuchadnezzar had a dream, which he knew how to interpret, and his wise men couldn't interpret it. He was very upset with them. And Daniel basically, stood up for these wise men, and he said to them, they're just not able to do it. You need Hashem to be, the Rabbanu Shalom is the one that's going to go ahead and reveal real secrets. They're not going to be able to do it. So he was basically trying to stand up for them to say, this is beyond them. So Rabbi Yaakov asks, why did he feel necessary to stand up for them? They weren't good people. They made lots of trouble. Why did he feel it so necessary to stand up on behalf of these wise men of Nebuchadnezzar? So Rabbi Yaakov says, to explain both Yosef and Daniel, is the pshat that, in essence, what is it that stops Paro from being able to recognize Hashem? What stops Nebuchadnezzar recognizing Hashem? The answer is that whenever something happens, what does he do? He turns to his wise men, and he says to them, what's going on? And they, with their wisdom, whatever it is, give an explanation. And therefore, there is no recognition of Hashem because it's all explained away. Therefore, when Yosef and Daniel had the chance amongst nations of the world to declare and say, it's not this stuff, it's the Ribbono Shel Olam, they did it. Because in the courts of the kings, the chances, the counterforce to recognizing of Hashem was the fact that they were surrounded by all these wise men giving explanation to everything. So now, basically, when the wise men failed, and Yosef has a way of going ahead and the wise men failed. So Paris says, Yosef, I hear that you know how to do things, right? You may be smarter than them. So Yosef realizes that now he has to go ahead and dispel this whole, this is his chance to say to Paris, you should recognize Hashem. Because Paris, again, looking for the wise men to go ahead and give it through his wisdom, interpret what's going on. And he says, I heard you know how to interpret dreams. If Yosef says, yeah, that's a lost opportunity to bring out to Paro that everything is running by the Rabbanu Shel Olam. When Daniel is speaking to the Nebuchadnezzar, he now has the ability to take away whatever is hindering the Nebuchadnezzar's ability to see the Rabbanu Shel Olam, which is explaining everything away through his wisdom, through his wise men. He can now point and say, no, this is the Rabbanu Shel Olam. And therefore, it wasn't just a Yosef is a tzaddik, he doesn't want to take credit for himself. Yosef has an opportunity, right? He has an opportunity to counter the forces that are challenging the forces of good that could exist, that could come to Paro or to Nebuchadnezzar. He now has the chance to dispel that and to bring out the ability for them to see and recognize the hand of Hashem. And therefore, that's what they were doing.